Okay, did we start on this last time, 2 weeks ago? Okay, so we've done bones. Now, of course, as we said, where bones come together, they form articulations or joints. So in the massage world, we generally tend to talk about the study of joints as syndesmology. It will likely be a very new word for most of you, which is the scientific study of ligaments and joints. Comes from the Greek element meaning connective tissue or ligament. You'll also see the term arthrology, or you'll see an arthrologist as a physician. So it's the study of joints applied to the body of knowledge related to joints, so named because Latin for joint is arthro. To define a joint represents where two bones come together. So it's the point of contact where two or more bones, between cartilage and bone or between teeth and bone, is a joint. Generally, when we look at it, it is the connection between structures, and again, structure governs function. Various degrees of skeletal movement occur as a result of the relationship of the bones to each other, and we're going to get into that a whole lot more. A joint is also known as an articulation. You'll see it that way as well. A ligament is slightly different. Whereas a tendon is related to a muscle that affects change on bone at the joint, ligament's whole role is to support a joint and prevent it from moving in a direction it shouldn't. So a ligament is a band of fibrous tissue, most often connecting bone to bone. And as I said, it either strengthens the joint or prevents unwanted movements. So sometimes a joint, if we were to remove ligaments, would have a multitude of movements, but because the ligaments are placed there, movements of the joint are extremely limited in some movements versus others. And as I said, a tendon is a cord of fibrous tissue, connective tissue really, attaching muscle to bone. And of course, its whole role is to transfer contractile forces from the muscle belly to the bone to allow for movement. It can play a role to strengthen a joint, right? We're going to find out with the shoulder and certainly with the knee. If we got some problems with a joint that's weakened for whatever reason, maybe a ligament has been damaged and a joint is considered to be unstable, then we want to strengthen those muscles that cross that joint to help strengthen the movement of ability. So what we see here, we've got a whole lot of things that can go on in a joint. We'll be talking about all of them tonight. And you can see here in the hip joint, we have a significant amount of ligamentous tissue here that is holding the joint. And of course, the hip has a lot of stability to it. It holds up our entire body weight as we move and walk. And we need a fairly strong, in fact, this is known as the Bigelow ligament, is actually one of the strongest ligaments in the entire body. When we look at joints, we look at it two ways. The first is what it's made of. So what kind of tissues make up a particular joint? If we're looking at what it's made up of, it is called a structural classification. The other way we classify joints is how much movement they have. So when we look at joints, we're either looking at, is the joint, you know, somewhat movable or very movable or not movable at all? Or at the other side of it, what's in it? What kind of tissues make up the joint? And again, thinking of that structure governs function, we have to consider, you know, what it looks like and what it allows for. So functional classifications then can be defined as movement. What kind of movement can the joint do, depending on them? So obviously, if we consider a tooth in its socket, what kind of movement would that have? Really, no movement, right? Okay, whereas a shoulder joint has lots of movement. Okay, so the first is functional classification is if a joint has no movement. If a joint has no movement, it is known as a synarthrosis. Okay, so a joint may be called synarthrosis. That tells you it does not move. This represents the suture between the plates of the skull, and what is called the gum fossa, which is where the tooth goes into the socket. So synarthrosis means no movement. Amphiarthrosis means there's limited or some allowable movement at the joint. Between the radius and ulna in the forearm and between the tibia and fibula in the lower leg, there is a space between those bones. So if we look at them, I'm trying to think if I've got a radius here. I'm not sure if I have an ulna anymore. There is a space between them. And we want, oh, let's do a fibula and a femur, or a tibia. So this is a tibia, and we can see here that we've got, oh, got upside down. There we go. And this is where the knee joint would be. This is where the ankle joint would be. And then we can put this fibula kind of like this, and you can see there's a space in between. In this space, there is a fibrous tissue that lies here. Now, these two don't quite fit because this is a little too long for it, but you get the sense of the space. So you can see here between the radius and the ulna, there is a membrane here, as well as there is a membrane between the fibula and the tibia. And it is that membrane, and depending on how short or long the fibers are, will result in how much movement there is or there is not between the two bones. Obviously, in the forearm, there's going to be a lot more movement of the two bones of the forearm than there is of the two bones of the lower leg. Why? Yep. The fibers limit a lot more movement in the lower leg as compared to the forearm, which has a lot of movement between the bones. Why? Yep. So what, but why would we have so much more allowable movement in the forearm as compared to the leg? Support, right. So we want the dexterity of the significant movement of the bones in the relationship in the forearm to do all the things that we can do, but we want a much tighter type of interosseous membrane between the tib and fib because we want stability between at that ankle joint and so forth, right? So this fibrous tissue that lies between the bones, because it's between the bones, is called the interosseous membrane. Quite often you'll see it written in notes with massage students as the IOM. It's not an unusual kind of acronym for it. The interosseous membrane, which in the drawing is this area right here that lies between the ulna and the radius. It allows for movability of the joints to some degree. Of course, it's a large surface area for muscle attachments as well. Fundamentally, though, where a synarthrosis does not allow for any movement at all, the relationship between the two bones and this interosseous membrane allow for some allowable movement, and this is known as an amphiarthrosis or an amphiarthritic joint, which means some allowable movement. The third type of functional classification is called a diarthrosis, and a diarthrosis is a completely movable joint, freely moving. So it's freely movable. It represents all the synovial joints, of which the vast majority of your body is made up of synovial joints. This is your shoulder, your hip, your knee, your elbow, and so forth. Okay? It's very, very movable. So our three then functional classifications are synarthrosis, no movement, amphiarthrosis, some movement, and diarthrosis, lots of movement. Okay, so that's the only three you need to know. No movement, some movement, lots of movement. Okay, so far so good. And we can see here, here's our lots of movement joints. We have the shoulder up here on the left, we have the knee on the upper right, we have the hip joint here on the lower right, and we have the joints between the bones of the fingers, again, allowing for movement. And there are a variety of movements that can occur. It can be dysflexion extension, could be ABA deduction, could be all of them, and we'll get into those as we move into the synovial joints. Now, the structural classifications is the classification of structures that make up the joint. So what kind of tissues do we see in the joint when we look at the tissues coming together, because we can have in the bag. There it is. Okay. We can have a joint. We can see it in the two examples here. You can see these squiggly little lines of the skull. And depending upon the tissue in them is movement of little movement or no movement. So the first one we're going to talk about are fibrous joints. Fibrous joints are represented by these sutures that we can see here in these two bones. They're a zipper-like kind of configuration that you can kind of see, and I'll pass these around. And they represent where the two bones of the plates of the skull come together and form a joint. Okay? Now, they only occur in the plates of the skull, and the bone edges interdigitate and are filled with connective tissue. So basically, to interdigitate is to make like a zipper. So you have one of the plates going like this, okay? And you have the other plate going like this. And in between them, we have this fibrous tissue. So obviously, interdigitation increases surface area of interaction between the two of them, and the zipper-like configuration of this interdigitation also provides lots of strength, okay? So we say they're interdigitated and are filled with connective tissue. Now, in adulthood, that fibrous tissue becomes more bone-like. And when it ossifies or becomes solid bone, it results in these junctions that are now called synostoses. Can I see that one for a sec? And the other one? Where's the other one? There for a moment. So I can tell between these two bones that this is an old person and this is a young person. Because listen, those plates of the skull, because obviously it's dead and the soft tissue has long since deteriorated and disappeared, it is not a synostosis yet. In this skull, it's a synostosis. It's solid. You can see the outline of the remnant sutures and the interdigitations, but this one is a young person because there's space between those interdigitations where the fibrous tissue has long since rotted away because obviously it's soft tissue. So this has nothing. This, you can see those bones actually move in relationship to each other because the fibrous tissue is gone. Yeah. This is getting into like 50s, 50s, 60s type of thing. You still have some of this. Now, how many people here have heard of a form or a modality of hands-on work called cranial sacral therapy? Anybody here? Larry, you? Anybody else over here? Cranial? Have you had it done? It's where they gently touch you and move your... Yes, okay. So cranial sacral therapy suggests that these plates do move, even in the adult. And they believe that your brain is bathed in a pool of fluid. It actually floats in your skull. And they believe that if the plates become imbalanced in any way, shape, or form, then the movement of those fluids in the brain don't function properly, and you get all kinds of clinical presentations. In fact, I used to work with one of the biggest cranial sacral gurus in Toronto. It was kind of one of the first clinics I ever worked in. And Mark used to work a lot on children because his teachings, when he took his form of cranial sacral therapy called Upledger, they believe that colic babies is because their skull plates are out, and they readjust them and remove colic. Yeah. Yeah. And they don't touch you with any more weight than that of a nickel and make the adjustments accordingly. If you've never had the therapy, because I'm like, whatever. And I went for a session, and I didn't recognize anything because there was no aggressive, like, you know, adjusting bones, that kind of stuff. And Mark said to me, he said, when you're at the table, be very careful. because you might feel a little bit off. And I'm like, he didn't do anything. I don't feel off. Sure enough, I went to get off the table, almost fell on the floor. There was a difference. There was the significant difference. So I don't say yes, I don't say no, but I do wonder, because it did affect a lot of change in me with the modality. Fundamentally, though, this represents a young skull with the fibrous tissue that has long since deteriorated away, where this represents an older individual where we now have a synostosis, where these loose fibrous joints are now completely solidified together and become solid bone. Because when I pass it around again, you'll check out the two, but in this one in particular, you'll note you can see the sutures in the skull. They're quite defined, but when you look on the inside, see any? Don't see them at all, do you? They're not there. And yet when you look on the young one, they're obviously, you can see them on the inside, but you can't see them here because this has become a solid bone. This is now a synostosis rather than a fibrous joint. Okay? Makes good cerebral. So, suture, fibrous joints, and when they do ossify and become solid, it is known as a synostosis. We can see here again, you can see the suture configuration with the fibrous tissue in between. The second type of fibrous joint is called a gomphosis, and this is the articulation between a tooth and the attachment to what is known as the alveolus in the jawbone. Is there any dental folks here? Because occasionally I do get dental hygienist or dentist or dental assisting folks. Anybody from dental here? Okay, doesn't matter. So you'll see here in the lower jaw, you'll see the holes. And those holes are where the roots of the teeth would have gone into in the healthy adult, right? These are known as alveolus. Now in this upper jaw, we can see we still have a tooth intact in the jaw that's remaining. The others have all fallen out, right? But they would have all, and this is still pretty anchored in. So they are anchored in. And soft tissue is, again, it's long since gone because this individual has been dead a very long time and all that material is deteriorated away. So gomphosis is the articulation, as I said, between the bone, a tooth and the attachment to the alveolus. The term gomphosis actually means nailed or bolted in. You can see it here that we have a tooth sitting. We've got the root of the tooth here. We can see the bone material that it's sitting in. And you'll note that there is a ligament that completely surrounds the root of the tooth, holding it in. Because all of you, if you just grab a tooth, you should be able to do a tiny bit of wiggling of a tooth, right? Because it is somewhat moving in that ligamentous material that's holding it in, as far as that goes. How many people here? Anybody here had a tooth removed while you were awake with freezing? What's it sound like? Yeah, because they're literally tearing that ligament as they pull the tooth out. They're actually tearing it. Yeah. And if you're like me, they squeeze so hard the tooth shatters and they have to start taking it out by little pieces. That was fun. Yeah. Yep. Right.
And does that mean that,
No, so what happens here, so if this is what's called a deciduous tooth, right, a baby tooth, right, your permanent teeth erupt from underneath and push it out of the alveolus, and the new tooth takes its place. So quite literally, the permanent tooth moves right into the spot where the deciduous or the temporary tooth was. So you just didn't grow an adult tooth underneath it. And, you know, it's interesting when you talk about teeth and jaws and that, the variation of the theme is incredible, you know, in terms of what, you know, because people say to me all the time, well, I've got a brother, he's 18 and he's still got all baby teeth, or just the variation is quite odd as to what happens in the development of teeth. But fundamentally, by now, you should have all, do you have your wisdom teeth?
No, I never do.
And you never have wisdom either. Okay. That happens. Anybody else with wisdoms?
I have one.
Or just one rather than four? Yeah. Again, you know what that is without the wisdom teeth? You're witnessing evolution, because we don't really need wisdom teeth anymore. Right? We're long since past that for the way we eat. So what you may be witnessing, because some of you do have wisdom and some of you have one and some of you have none, is probably actually evolution really doing its thing because we're moving away from it.
So for us, when our wisdom teeth come in,
yeah. Oh yeah, like if you look at old, if they go to old sites for archaeology, they'll see jaws that are massively deformed, where there was massive rot breaking down bone tissue that was, you know, bone disappearing and teeth crooked and doing all sorts of things. Oh yeah, yeah. Oral health back in the day wasn't so good. But you know what's interesting? Nomadic tribes in Africa, like you would think, you know, way back when, or when we were in the beginnings of our evolutionary design, you would have said, you know, well, they lived shorter and they had really poor health and whatever. They have since discovered that actually it's the exact opposite, that ancient peoples actually lived very good long lives because they lived very healthy. They, you know, they ate, they didn't overeat. They ate a varied diet, mostly of vegetables, not meats, because kind of hard to track down a saber-toothed tiger because, you know, you just got a little spear and sort of thing. And they actually lived a long time. It's where we've got to with, you know, with factories and institutionalization of food and so forth, that's actually led to all these diseases that's killing us, heart disease, cancer, all those sorts of things. We got to get back to eating the way we were supposed to. Never in the history of mankind, except for the last 50 years, we have always been hungry. We're not hungry anymore. If you're hungry, what do? You eat. Our forefathers, if they were hungry, they might have to wait a day or two.
And they would drink water.
Yeah, so. Okay, so that was your fibrous joints. The next type of fibrous joint is called a syndesmosis. You're going to hear terms that sound the same, but that are different a lot tonight. Okay, so a syndesmosis is a fibrous joint in which bones are connected by a cord or sheet of fibrous tissue, such as the interosseous membrane, and interosseous membrane in its relationship to bones is what kind of movable joint? Amphiarthrotic, correct. Okay, it's an amphiarthrosis. So that sheet that lies between the two bones is a syndesmosis. Now, as I said earlier, depending on the length of fibers, the two bones may move a lot, or may move a little bit. So obviously the fibers are longer in the forearm, hence we have more movement between the radius and ulna, and they're much shorter in the interosseous membrane between the tibia and fibula, so we have less movement. So we're saying the distal tibiofibular joint fibers are relatively short as compared to those of the interosseous membrane of the radius and ulna. So more movement between the radius and ulna, less movement between the tibia and fibula, which makes sense because we want that stability in the lower leg versus greater range of motion in the forearm. Okay, so far so good. Okay, we can see the interosseous membrane here. We can see the length of the fibers. So the sutures and gomphosis are considered synarthroidal by definition. Some schools of thought, as I said, support the theory of palpable movement of the cranial plates, cranial sacral therapy. But ultimately, sutures and gomphosis are synarthroidal. The syndesmosis is considered to be amphiarthroidal, whose degree of movement depends on the length and flexibility of the uniting fibrous tissue, of course, which is the interosseous membrane. So that was fibrous joints. Now we're going to do cartilaginous joints. So fibrous joints, there is fibrous connective tissue where the two bones come together. Cartilaginous joint is where the two bones come together, we find cartilage. Okay? The first is primary cartilaginous, known as a synchondrosis. What I would recommend, because they all sound the same, is to do a little chart for yourself. So you put all these terms down one side and their definition beside them, because they all sound very similar, don't they? We have our synarthrosis, a synchondrosis, right? Okay, they're all sounding somewhat the same, but they're different. So a synchondrosis are joints as a joint where bones are united by hyaline cartilage. They tend to be temporary with ossification in adulthood, and the prime example of a synchondrosis is the growth plate or the epiphyseal plate. Remember, we talked a little bit about that when we were looking at the area between the epiphysis and the diaphysis, where we had the metaphysis and we found the growth plate. Do you remember that? So that growth plate is represented as being called a synchondrosis. There are a couple of spots where our authors do argue that there is an existing synchondrosis in the adults. We're not going to get that picky with things, okay? So we can see here in these gray areas here, we have the epiphyseal plates here, and they are a synchondrosis. Next is a symphysis. Now, sorry? No, the metaphysis is between the diaphysis and the epiphysis. So there would be a growth plate here as well in a child. But remember, the epiphysis has to grow as well. So for whatever reason, the artist decided to put the epiphyseal plates here in the spongy bone in the epiphysis rather than in the metaphysis area. But there would be one there as well if it was a child. Okay. Next is called a symphysis. The articular surface of bones are covered with hyaline and then joined to a fibrocartilaginous plate. So if I were to do something like this, you would see that there would be this cartilage that's very connected here at the ends of the bones. I know there's a bit of a space there, but that's just so you can see it. There really wouldn't be a space. And then there is a disc between the two. So like so. Okay. So the bones are covered in hyaline cartilage, and then that hyaline cartilage attaches to a disc that lies between the two bones. So hyaline and then the disc. This fibrocartilage is really important. It's very compressible, almost like a shock absorber type of thing, and very resilient to forces. Therefore, it acts as a shock absorber, which allows limited movement. There are a couple places we get it. The two that are important is first what's called the intervertebral disc. So this is a disc that lies between the vertebra in the spine, between every spinal segment, or almost every one. There is a disc. And the other place is the pubic symphysis, which is right at the pubic bone where it comes together anteriorly in the center. This is also a symphysis. Again, the two pelvic bones come around, are coated in hyaline cartilage, and then we have a fibrocartilaginous disc in between. Okay, now when we walk in the movements of the hips, you would think it's locked in, but it's not. The hip actually does quite a number of movements for us to be able to ambulate accordingly and properly. And of course, ladies, this configuration also allows for expansion of the pelvic bones during the birthing process, which opens up the birth canal and does make room for that head, that very large head, to kind of pop out to some degree. Okay? So we can see it here in the pelvic bone. We can't see the hyaline cartilage here, but the hyaline would be right against the bone with the disc in between. So a synchondrosis is synarthroidal, and the symphysis is amphiarthroidal. Again, no movement with the synchondrosis, some allowable movement with the amphiarthrosis, with the symphysis. The next one is the big one, our synovial joints. And now a synovial joint is the most common joint in the human body. The majority of joints in your body are synovial in nature. The synovial joint allows for unbelievable amounts of movement, depending on which joint we're talking about. They can be uniaxial, biaxial, or multiaxial in nature. And of course, remember, structure governs function. How they relate to each other in these joints represent how much movement they do or they don't have, and how much movement they allow for, flexion, extension, AB, adduction, and so forth. They are named according to their movements, so depending on what they do, they're either called plane or hinge or pivot or condyloid or saddle or ball and socket, and we will get to those in the next set of slides. Fundamentally, synovial joints, the plane joint, hinge, and pivot are considered uniaxial, The condyloid and the saddle joint is considered to be biaxial, and the ball and socket joints are considered to be multiaxial, and all are diarthroidal. They all move a lot.
What would the wrist be?
The wrist?
Is that a saddle joint? Or,
some is and some aren't.
That's the thing.
So the thumb is a saddle joint, but they are plane joints in actuality. They're cuboidal in nature, so think of you've got rows of dice, you know, you play craps with, and they all line up to each other, and they all slide and glide. So they're all plane joints, which allow for the varied movements that the wrist allows for.
So it's,
if you're talking about the true wrist joint,
yeah,
they all still slide and glide in relationship to each other. But don't forget, the wrist is not just the carpal bones, but you also have the metacarpals distal to that, which is in this area here, more distal, and allows for even more to happen as far as that goes. Okay? But they're all diarthroidal. Okay. So, that being said, let's talk about synovial joints. Because they are the most popular in there, and just about every joint we talk about is going to be synovial to some degree. So within the introduction of these synovial joints, when we say that something is a synovial joint, there are certain structures within this joint that are absolute to every single synovial joint we talk about. So we're going to do those ones first, and then there are some one-offs that are unique to some joints, but not to any. So the first things we're going to talk about is, if I say this is a synovial joint, these things are guaranteed to be in there. Okay? So we can see here, this is pretty much the common sort of rendition the artist does in most books. We can see space here and all kinds of structures that we're going to talk about. So we must remember that a synovial joint is diarthroidal, which means it's freely moving. And there are five common structures to any synovial joint. The first is it's wrapped. Every synovial joint has a membrane that goes around it, right? Every single one, whether it's as small as the two zygapophyseal joints in the spine or as large as a ball and socket joint in the pelvis, that whole entire joint is surrounded by a membrane. Every synovial joint has a membrane. And there are two parts to that membrane. First is an external layer, and that external layer is tough and flexible. It is continuous with the periosteal layer of the bone. Remember I talked about how there's a skin on bone, right? The periosteum. Well, the outer capsule of the joint is a continuation of that same fibrous tissue that's very, very tough. Because it's tough and fibrous in nature, the outer layer is commonly known as the fibrous capsule. So you'll hear me use that term quite a bit and quite often. Deep to the fibrous layer is the internal layer. So we have the outer tough fibrous layer, and then we have an inner very thin layer, and this is known as the internal layer. It's loose. It is basically very vascular connective tissue, so a lot of blood vessels and so forth there. It lines the fibrous capsule on the inside. It covers all the internal joint surfaces except where the bones actually touch. Does that make sense? Okay, so if we were to sort of put these two together here, okay, the ball and socket. Of course, the first thing would be this whole thing, ball and socket, where my fingers are. It would be covered in fibrous capsule. Underneath that would be the synovial membrane that would surround that again. But where the two bones actually meet, so this whole surface of the ball and this whole surface of the acetabulum, or most of it, there is no inner internal synovial layer. Last thing we'd want to do is take that layer and get it pinched between two bones in the joint, right? So where the bones actually meet, we don't find the internal layer. So we say it covers all internal joint surfaces except the articular cartilage. And this is the true synovial membrane. So we have the fibrous capsule, and then we have the true synovial membrane that lies underneath it, deep to it on the inside. So we can see here the artist's rendition. We can see here in blue, the artist has drawn the fibrous capsule, and we can see how it's a continuation of the periosteum. And then deep to that, kind of like a flesh tone, if you're up close here, it's all lined with this synovial membrane. And you can see it goes right up to here and right to here. But where the two bones touch, there is no synovial membrane. Now, this synovial membrane is kind of important. It has cells in it that produce something we're going to talk about a little bit later on, which is the fluid that we find in the joint. There's a fluid in here. Oh, sorry, let me put your hand up. There is now a cavity as well. When we look at a synovial joint, we have this fibrous capsule, we have this internal synovial membrane, but there is also a bit of a cavity here. And it is this cavity that lies around the bones that articulate and kind of between them, but not much. But you'll get that in a second. The space is more potential than real. What does that mean? It means that when we look at the articulation between the two bones with the naked eye, it looks like they're actually touching, but in fact, they're not. Okay, so there's something in between the two of them under normal circumstances, but there is a space just the same. So when artists, again, draw these renditions, the space is represented by red in this drawing, which is, looks huge, right? It doesn't look like that in the normal anatomical sense. Again, it's potential. It looks like everything's tightly packed, and rightly so, it should. But again, artists tend to draw those bigger spaces, so as a learning student, you can kind of make it out. Within this joint cavity, there is synovial fluid, but drops of it. Anybody here ever blown up a knee? Playing sports, like get the big swollen knee, inflamed knee, or inflamed shoulder, right? So what happens to that inflammation is you get excessive amounts of synovial fluid created, and the knee blows up. And if you're like me, they come in with a needle and they drain it. They drain it all out and make you feel better. No, they freeze it. You don't feel a thing. You don't feel a thing. Actually, it feels kind of nice because usually that swelling fluid is actually uncomfortable, and then when it comes down, it starts to function a bit better. Okay, so, yes. Yes, it works as a lubrication. It also works as a bit of a shock absorber. The best way I explain the potential space and the fluid, and I may have said this to you guys before, if you've been in biology before in high school and you had two microscopic plates, you know, the glass plates, and you put a drop of fluid on the plate and you put the two plates together, they're actually not touching each other, are they? And those plates can kind of slide against each other, but when you look at it with the naked eye, they look like they're touching each other and completely together. Same idea here, right? There are only a few drops in there because everything's so tightly packed, but it tends to be enough. Are you sure the synovial cysts? That's interesting. Could be chronic inflammation related to rheumatoid arthritis or something like that. Are they knobby? Are her fingers all knobby and crooked? Was she a typist or anything like that at all? Oh. Yeah, She might have a bit of chronic inflammation, which has resulted in deposition of calcium, that kind of stuff. Yeah, quite possible. So, again, we have the space and we have the fluid in there. And the fluid comes from the synovial membrane that lies deep to the fibrous capsule. That's where it's coming from. So this fluid, it's secreted into the joint cavity by the cells of the synovial membrane. It looks exactly like the white of an egg before you cook it. It's clear, and if you ever get the white of the egg on your finger, it's slippery, sticky, viscous. This is exactly the same. So it is of the viscous egg white consistency, which becomes less viscous as it's warmed by joint movement. Hence the reason for exercise, why we want to warm up. Because as we warm up for exercise, the fluid in the joint becomes slipperier, and therefore the potential for damage or injury goes down. Okay? So it reduces friction between the articular surfaces. It provides phagocytic cells to rid the joint cavity of microbes and cellular debris. So there's these big eater cells in there that help keep the space clean. And it nourishes the articular cartilage. Because we're going to learn in clinical anatomy that cartilage is avascular and aneural. It does not have its own blood supply. So how does it get what it needs to meet its metabolic needs? In the case of the joints here, It is a synovial fluid that provides nourishment to keeps cartilage healthy. One of the things that can happen in certain arthritic conditions, such as rheumatoid arthritis, is that that synovial fluid actually dries up. And then the joints start grinding together and you get inflammation and so on and so forth. It happens in osteoarthritis as well. To the point where if you have the opportunity, because eventually you guys are going to long-term care, you might have a patient in long-term care and you'll get them to move the knee and it'll sound just like a creaky hinge in an old house. It's just, you just hear it, it just creaks. Because the two bones no longer are nice and slippery against each other. They're actually grinding against each other. Okay? I haven't got the number one question I always get asked at this point. What happens when my fingers crack?
Oh, no. It's like popping
into
the air in the
snowfield,
right?
Yeah, so it's not a bad thing unless you do it where you jam the joints together. So this type is bad. If you truly want to crack your fingers, pull them apart. Yeah, because you get the joint, the two bones away from each other, they don't do damage. But if you do all this cracking stuff, you're actually jamming the bones together. And again, if you don't take care of your joints, think of that creaking and cracking. You're just little flakes of that cartilage you're getting knocked off, and you never replace it. You can't replace that cartilage. Yeah. Yeah, you're literally, think of it as like a cartilaginous bruise. So you've taken the two pieces of cartilage together and you've jammed them. It's basically like a sprained finger. You treat it exactly the same way. You splint it. You put it in a proper position. Let the inflammation kind of run its course. If there's any damage to ligaments, then you have to deal with that. Have you ever had to put a finger back in? I used to do it all the time. My buddies, because I played a lot of competitive basketball, and they knew it didn't bug me. So, you know, you get guys in basketball and their fingers like at 90 degrees over here, and they're like, can you put my finger back? I'm like, sure can. Nick, put it right back in again. Okay, so the last one. No, one more to go. We have articular cartilage. Now, when we look at all these bones I have here, especially it's a little easier to see. So we've got the humerus here, which is the upper arm. We've got the femur here, which is the lower leg. Well, we have a ball to some degree on both of them. This is femur. Oh, sorry, femur, upper leg. And this is the humerus of the upper arm. I mean, probably that's where I said it, where I said upper leg. So, got two balls. These two balls, whether it's a full ball like in the femur or a partial in the humerus, that smooth ball would have been completely covered in articular cartilage. So where the two bones come together, yeah.
The partial, is that a head?
Yeah, it's the head.
So it's considered a head even if it's like a partial?
Yep. Yeah, it just... What you're going to learn next semester is that this configuration allows for greater mobility, where this configuration allows for more stability in the lower leg. So this smooth area is where we would have had articular cartilage, which is usually hyaline. So where the two bones come together, in most cases in synovial joints, when the two bones come together, they're both covered in hyaline. So we have articular hyaline, where they come together, along with synovial fluid. And that's what allows for lots of movement, less breaking down of the joint surfaces and lasting a bit longer. There's virtually no nerve or blood supply to this cartilage, and therefore it needs its nutrients from the synovial fluid by what's called weeping lubrication. So the fact that we move a joint and fluid moves around while we're moving, it helps maintain the health of cartilage. You'll probably notice, no, you won't notice because you're all too young, but back in the day, way in the day, if you had something like a joint problem or a broken bone, they put you in bed for 6 weeks and said you can't move. Well, then we wonder why they were all dying of pneumonia and all those sorts of things. We now know that if you've got like an orthopedic procedure done, for example, in some cases, they want you up moving a joint as soon as possible because they know those movements help maintain healthy cartilage and so on and so forth. So it is the movement that's important. So number four is the joint, the bones are covered in hyaline cartilage, which you can see here in the blue. The fifth are ligaments. They strengthen and reinforce joint stability. They limit movement in undesirable directions. So the body places ligaments in appropriate relationship to the joint, which prevents inappropriate movements. I think I already asked already. Anybody here take jiu-jitsu? Ever asked that before? So jujitsu is about, again, putting a joint in a direction it's really not supposed to go. And if they don't say uncle, then you can pop all those ligaments. That's what happens. In the early days of UFC, that used to happen all the time. You'd see guys, the arm, then you just hear it go, oh, there it goes. Dude's done. These ligaments that are providing joint stability, they can be extrinsic, also known as extracapsular, which means that they sit outside the fibrous capsule. But they can also be intrinsic or capsular, and therefore these ligaments can share fibers with the fibrous capsule. Or in some cases, the fibrous capsule thickens and acts as a ligament. You want me to repeat that? Okay. So you have ligaments that are completely away from the fibrous capsule. They sit all by themselves. They're by them, right? So those are known as extracapsular or extrinsic. In other cases, ligaments intimately share fibers with the fibrous capsule, or the fibrous capsule is thickened to act as a ligament. Those are known as intracapsular ligaments or intrinsic. And so those are going to come up on a number of occasions. The ligament is either extrinsic or intrinsic. There's a classic example in the knee, but just ask Michelle about that in lab. Yeah. Ligaments are connective tissue. Strong connective tissue, fibrous connective tissue. Okay? They have no relationship to tendons at all. They just hold bones together. Right? So prevent them from moving. So we can see here there's a number of them. Right? We've got here in the knee, for example, we have the fibular collateral ligament. You may know it as the lateral collateral ligament on the outside of the knee. It has no attachment to the capsule. It runs free all by itself. On the medial aspect of the knee, there is a medial collateral or a tibial collateral ligament on the inside. It shares fibers with the joint capsule. So the lateral collateral does not. It's all by itself, so it's extracapsular. And the inner or medial collateral ligament shares fibers with the fibrous membrane, so it's said to be intrinsic. Right. Okay, everybody understand that? So this is why, folks, if someone has a knee injury in football, if there's damage to the medial collateral ligament, because it does intimately attach to the fibrous capsule and certain components of the knee, it does a lot more damage because of that attachment. Whereas if you do damage to the fibular or lateral collateral, just the ligament can be injured and the knee is completely fine. Okay? So intracapsular or extracapsular. Yeah, because the fibula is on the outside. So those are the five things that every time I tell you that a joint is synovial, it has all of those. Fibrous capsule, synovial membrane, joint cavity, synovial fluid, articular cartilage, okay, and ligaments. Every single synovial joint has those, hands down, every time I tell you that a joint is synovial. Whether it's a plane joint, a ball and socket joint, an ellipsoid joint, it makes no difference. Every single synovial membrane, every single synovial joint has all five of these things.
Is the articular
and joint capsule the same thing? Yes, they can be the same. Yes. Everybody follow me? So now we're going to take the things that are sometimes in some synovial joints, but not in others. So riddle me this. How are we doing here first? Yeah, okay. So this is a femur, and this is a tibia, okay? What kind of look does that distal femur have? What's it look like? I'm not trying to get that complicated. Is it convex or concave?
I mean, parts of it are concave.
These two things right here. Let's get more. These two things are condyles. Okay. Not everybody will know what it's a condyle. Okay. These two condyles, are they convex or concave? These two? Convex. So they are ultimately round, correct? Okay. So we're just going to do this. So the first is our distal femur has two balls. Okay? They're round, they're convex. Now, the proximal tibia, what's that look like? It's flat. Correct?
Oh,
but ultimately it's flat. Don't get too complicated. Okay. All right. Okay. So if we put two balls on a flat surface, how stable is that? Not stable at all. So we have a distal femur with two convex condyles sitting on a tabletop. What's the problem with that? Yeah, it's not very stable. The term we use is congruent. You may have heard that term somewhere else. This is, as it sits, it is not very congruent. Round on flat. Potential to go all over the place. So how do we fix that? We put in something that the balls can sit in. So, get rid of that. So, between the tabletop and the balls, we put in a cup. Looks like this. And then, those cups sit on top of the tabletop like that. What did we just do? We just stabilized it. Okay? We've created these two fibrocartilaginous cups that the balls can sit in. Therefore, we've taken an incongruent joint and made it congruent by sitting it in. All right? Those two cups are called meniscus. And you may have heard that term with football injuries. You know, the athlete blew their meniscus out or whatever. Ultimately, these are tiny cups that the distal femur condyles actually sit in, which provides a greater congruency. So, these are discs or wedges, the fibrocartilaginous that separate the articular surfaces. They have no nerve supply except that they're attached margins. I'm not going to get too complicated, but I've done a lot of reading on it for a reason recently, and I've discovered, or the research is now discovering, when we're young, like quite young, like teenage years, these are actually relatively, innervated with arteries, and they are fed quite a bit. As we get older, those, meaning like 1920, blood supply all goes out to the periphery, and no longer do they have as much to be able to heal. Worse with ladies than with men. How many have girlfriends here, soccer players, rugby players, they've blown their meniscus and their knees out? Really common, right? Because those meniscus aren't as strong in females because of the lack of blood supply. So they have a greater potential for injury to menisci, right, as compared to men. So when you start practicing, you're going to see this. A fair greater number of female soccer players, for example, have knee problems as compared to males. And it all has to do with this change of a blood supply to get them. But ultimately, the edges are still alive, shall we say, in the middle, not so much. Okay? So, they improve the fit between incongruent bony structures. Therefore, we say they provide increased stability to the joint. So, we only find menisci in certain joints, for example, the knee, okay, and one other. Does anybody know what that is? It might surprise you. Sorry. Close. You're in the right area. Temporal mandibular joint. So your jaw joint actually has a meniscus in it. Yes. And I spent a bit of time on that because do you guys know we treat TMJ, temporal mandibular joints, in the mouth. Will you actually put gloves on and go in someone's mouth and work on them? I spent a lot of time specializing in that. I think it's a pretty cool joint to work on. Causes a lot of problems in people. Because how many people here wear night guards?
I don't, but I'm supposed to,
yeah. Yeah. Yeah, what's that? Oh, yeah, get another one or you'll end up like me, broken teeth everywhere.
Yeah,
that's just sort of feeling hard. Yep. So we can see here... From, I like this view. So we're looking down on the proximal tibia. And you can see, now this is a drawing that does have a tear in it, because it's not unusual to have a tear. But we can see how it deepens the outer margins and then allows that the distal femur, and the condyles to fit in, which makes for a much more congruent joint. And we do have a little tiny meniscus in here in our jaw joint, which we'll talk a whole lot more about in the coming days or coming weeks. Okay? So meniscus. Yeah. It can slide out. Yeah, so you can provide enough trauma to this area that this can shift. How many people here have clicky joint and jaw? Okay, that's because the meniscus keeps slipping out of place and you're actually bouncing over it. And think about it, every time you bounce over it, a little piece of it's gone forever. That's why you wear a night guard. Every time it clicks, a little piece of it's gone, and it never comes back. Yeah. Yep. I click. So that's a bit different. I may need a surgical intervention to rebuild, possibly, at down the end of the day. But without that kind of stuff, yeah. Trust me, when we get there, I'll talk a whole lot about it, because it's a kind of a cool, I think it's a cool thing. Especially when you help people, they actually cry. I had a woman that actually couldn't put two fingers in her mouth. By the time I was finished with her, she hadn't opened her mouth that wide since she was 11 years old. It's pretty cool. The other thing that allows for greater congruency is called a labrum. Labrum is actually Latin for lip, okay? So we have something similar to a meniscus in that it deepens the socket, shall we say, and makes the joint more congruent. So a labrum is a fibrocartilaginous ring which deepens the socket of the articular surface of the bone. We have two of them. We have the glenoid labrum, which is in the shoulder between the proximal humerus and the scapula at the glenoid fossa. And then we have the acetabular labrum, which, of course, is between the proximal femur and the acetabulum of the hip bone, where the ball and socket joint is there. So we can see here, kind of in a cross-section, we can see where the artist has drawn an extension in blue here, which is the lip of the labrum. We can see it here as well. But we can see it much better here. So this is the humeral head. Again, where it's white, that will be articular cartilage. That will be the hyaline cartilage. And we can see that the concavity of the glenoid fossa, we can see there's a lip all the way around it. And that somewhat deepens the joint between the ball of the humerus and the socket of the scapula. So it's a lip that goes all the way around the outside of the joint. Okay, everybody follow me? So you have two labrums. Now, obviously, the labrum in the pelvic area is a much deeper, larger labrum because, again, stability. And we have a much smaller labrum in the shoulder because we want to maintain high mobility for that shoulder joint. Structure governs function. Okay? I know when I first said it, you went, what? But now it makes sense, doesn't it? The next thing. Okay, so quandary me this. And I apologize for the stick people. But I'm going to keep it relatively simple. So you're out climbing. Okay? You're out climbing with a friend. And you're on a cliff. Okay? You're on a cliff. And you're up here. Right? And your friend's down here. And then you're trying to help them up with a rope. What's the potential there to that rope? Why is it going to break? Okay. Change the angle and to prevent it from... Right. Rubbing on here, correct? So the same thing happens in the human body. Wherever we have joints that cross, we have to worry about that. So what if I put a nice big thick blanket here? Then what would happen? What would happen? Would we decrease the potential of the rope fraying and breaking? Okay. The human body does exactly the same thing. Wherever tendons cross joints or bones, the body places a structure between said tendon and bone to prevent any wear and tear, and this is called a bursa. So we find them all over the body. Again, where tendons cross bony structures, the body places. So all of you palpate your elbow. You are not actually palpating your bone. You're actually palpating a bursa that lies between your skin and your elbow joint. That's a different thing altogether. Yeah. What's that? You can't feel anything? So you can't feel the bursa. It's very, very tight. So not only does the body place bursa where tendons cross bone, they also place bursa where skin has the potential to rub against bone as well. So you have a bursa between the bone of your elbow and the skin. So you think you're actually palpating bone, you're not. Now there is a condition of a bursitis, we used to call it student's elbow, because you know students are like this on the counter all the time. And this is called the olecranon bursa. You look that up. Look, if anybody's got your phone or your computer, look up olecranon bursitis and see how big this thing can get. Olecranon.
Oh, Lord. Yep.
Yeah, that's the bursa completely filled with fluid because it's inflamed.
Oh, God. It looks like a heel.
Yeah, I'm sorry. And it can happen in the knee. It can happen in the shoulder. Wherever there's a bursa, you can get a bursitis. As a what? No. Yeah, you could call it an infusion. You could. But usually with a knee infusion, they're talking about fluid collection in the synovial capsule. Not. If it's the bursa, it's called a bursitis. Okay? So you can see how big that is, and you don't even know it's there right now because it's not inflamed. Yeah. It can get quite large.
Is it still as hard when it's like...
No, it's you can tap it and it just like it's full fluid, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So, as I said, it functions to reduce friction where ligaments, tendons, and skin overlie bone. So we have a whole bunch in the knee, we have a ton in the shoulder, and we're gonna have to know a few of them, but that's all for next semester when you do shoulder and that. In some cases, they can be an extension of the synovial membrane. So sometimes, like the one you're just looking at, the olecranon, it sits all by itself. But sometimes, some bursa in the knee or shoulder joint, that synovial membrane pops out from underneath the fibrous capsule and acts as a bursa. So we find that sometimes too. Yes, fluid-filled, so it's... Well, it is. You don't notice it because, I mean, if you think of like when we talked about potential space, because yours isn't inflamed right now, it's a potential space. So you do really feel like you're touching bone. Now, I had a friend in high school. She slipped on the ice and she slammed her elbow into the pavement and she burst her bursa and it disappeared. If you were to palpate her, you'd recognize just how rough that olecranon actually is. But the reason why you guys all feel it as smooth and rolling around is because that bursa is intact and working just the way it's supposed to. No, not at all. That's an entirely different, that's a tendonitis of any one of three muscles in the forearm. Yeah.
When you hit your funny bone.
Yep, that's the ulnar nerve.
That's your nerve.
Yeah. Okay, so you can see here, you know, we've got a prepatella bursa. So you have the same kind of bursa between the skin in your knee and your knee, like your patella, like your kneecap.
Do you want to like both sides?
No, there's one under, there's one on top,
yes.
And there's one in the front. Just this three right off the top of my head with the knee. Okay. Again, it's just protecting friction. It's just trying to prevent from fraying that tendon or skin as it's moving over and across bone. So you can see all here. Look at them all. Right? You've got subacromial, subdeltoid, subcoracoid, subscapular. And these are all we find in the shoulder. And they can be buggers. They get inflamed, and then the shoulder doesn't work properly. And you're going to hear this quite often from patients in the clinical setting. They got shoulder pain. They've been to the doctor, and the doctor said they have shoulder bursitis. And guess what? I would say, what about you? About 70% are wrong?
Yes.
About 70-75% of shoulder bursitis are not shoulder bursitis at all. At all. Well, we can test, yeah, you can do an ultrasound, you can do an MRI, but just from clinically, just doing all the tests to make a shoulder work, you'll go, it's not a bursitis. About 70%. A tendon sheath. So a tendon sheath is like a bursa. So you've got maybe a tendon that's running through a groove. For example, in the shoulder, I'm going to take a break here in a second. Yeah, in a second. I just want to finish the thought. You've got a groove here that a tendon runs through where my finger is, okay? Again, potential for friction, rubbing, and so on and so forth. So rather than a flat bursa, sac-like bursa here, what the body does, it extends the synovial membrane and makes a slippery tube. So that when that tendon is running through this groove, it's actually running through a tube of slippery synovial membrane. This is known as a tendon sheath. So a synovial structure which wraps around a muscle tendon, think of it as an elongated bursa, and it allows the tendon to move more freely over bony structures. Now you have quite a number of them in your lower forearm, and there's a couple of conditions where it's called Decrovanes tenosynovitis. And this is where the extensor muscles run through these synovial tubes. I once had a gentleman who was an Olympic rower or paddler, and he had inflamed that tube. And every time he moved his hands, and I'm not kidding you, because that tube was dry, and you were literally hearing, almost like doing a violin with a string, of the tendon actually rubbing against the synovial sheath that was dry because it was inflamed. You treat it just like a tendonitis, ultrasound, anti-inflammatories, that kind of stuff. But it's a sleeve, you can see here, a synovial sleeve that completely wraps around the tendon and gives it a nice slippery environment for it to slide back and forth into, again, providing protection against friction as the tendon's working. Okay? So this one is showing it this way. Here's all kinds of them right here. This is a huge one in your hand because all the tendons of all the hand all run through a synovial sheath. There are 14 muscles in that forearm, and none of them are in the hand, and yet they all affect fingers. Yes? Yes, it gets paid. Yeah, so what brought the Decrovanes that the gentleman had brought him into physio. I worked in physio beforehand because it hurt. It burns every time that tendon moves through that dry sheath. And, you know, anybody here has a tendonitis, you know how much that can burn and hurt and be irritating and a pain in the butt. It's no different, be the same thing. Okay, so again, the example, tendon of biceps brachii within the inner tubercular groove, and it kind of looks like this. Now, I want to show you something just real quick. This is the glenohumeral joint, the shoulder. You know, you talk about structure governs function. So the fibrous capsule in the shoulder, this is just, I won't examine you on this, but this is just to get you to understand how the body works. What do you see here with the fibrous capsule? What's it doing? It's kind of extra, isn't it? It's kind of hanging down. Okay? I need that. If that was a tight capsule, I wouldn't be able to do this. So the fact that this fibrous capsule kind of hangs like a teardrop and is loose allows that full range of motion of the shoulder. So when I'm in this position, this fibrous capsule down here is actually tight. And then when I come down here, it gets really loose again. Anybody here heard the term frozen shoulder? Okay, that's when this gets stuck. So you get inflammation and stickiness here, and that fibrous capsule sticks together. They can only get to here, and that's as far as they can get.
Like,
No, I have to actually say it's the exact opposite, because if you think from an evolutionary perspective, and if we truly did come from primates, what do primates do? Swing around on vines and trees. So their shoulders are much more mobile than ours for their need to be able to do the things that a lot of the traditional primates are able to do. So we actually gave up a little bit of it. But it's fascinating, because you think of the tools we've designed, weapons to hunt and those sorts of things. It's quite fascinating, though, the things that we can do in terms of throwing spears and all those sorts of things, right, for survival and that kind of stuff. Take a break. We'll see you guys between 5-2 and 10-2. There we go. Let us continue, please. So, we talked about bursa, we talked about synovial sheaths for tendons. So, tendons, just as a reminder, when we do the comparison between tendons and ligaments, remember, tendons are a form of what's called regular connective tissue, which we'll be taking in the other class. It is an extension of the connective tissues of the muscle itself, which I will be explaining at some point here. Tendons can, as I said, can help stabilize a joint, because remember, rule number one is, a muscle can only affect change on a joint that it crosses. So if a muscle doesn't cross the joint, it won't affect that joint. It has to cross the joint. It transfers the forces generated by the muscle cells, and where the tendon crosses the joint, it causes specific movements at that joint. Remember I said muscles are stupid, and it's where they lie in relationship to the axis of movement that results in the movement that muscles give us. Ligaments, on the other hand, are made of connective tissue as well, but their whole role is to stabilize the joint and to prevent inappropriate movements of said joint.
What's the difference between regular connective tissue and connective tissue?
All will be explained in
A&P. Okay.
Yeah. It all has to do with the fiber direction and all that kind of stuff. So let's do types of synovial joints. The first is called gliding or a plane joint. Yes, most of these have two names. Okay? So they tend to be relatively small, and they allow small sliding or gliding movements. So think of two flat surfaces that are sliding or gliding in a multitude of directions. Yeah, like facets for between vertebra. Yes, and we'll be getting into those quite heavily. Okay, but yes, so it's this kind of movement of just two flat surfaces sliding against each other. In other words, the opposing articular surfaces are essentially flat. Now, those facet joints of the spine, their proper name is a zygapophyseal joint. Those flat joints of the spine, we'll get back to this. Their proper name is a zygapophyseal joint. Okay? The acromial or clavicular joint, so between the clavicle and the acromion, is a slide-glide joint. And the intercarpal joints, when you're asking about the wrist, those carpal joints all slide and glide against each other. Yes, they'd be biaxial, correct.
And they're all biaxial?
Yes, correct. Plane or? It's plane or gliding. A plane joint glides. A glide joint planes. I want to put it that way. Okay, so we can see here a couple squares, right? They're sliding against each other's articular surfaces. And these gliding and sliding of these carpal bones are what allows us to do this in our hands, okay? It's those interactions of that sliding and gliding allows for that. The next is called the hinge joint, also known as a gingivalous joint. It allows for flexion and extension movements only. Now, we did this last week. I think that was the other class. Where did my... Did I not have it all now? I thought I did. Oh, here it is. Okay, so your elbow joint is a gingivalous joint. We say that a convex or cylindrical projection of one bone fits into a concave or cylindrical groove of another bone. This is the ulnar bone. This is the distal humerus. The distal humerus is a tubular convexity, and the proximal ulna is a round concavity that they fit together. So, no, the radius isn't, at this point, is only a tiny little circular bone. So, concavity into a convexity. Now, you can see here that they fit so well, they can't do any other movements except flex and extend. Okay? Now, ligaments also hold this in place as well, but it flexes and extends, and you can see how it moves around that tube. That concavity moves around that tube, which allows for flexion and extension, right? Characteristically, it's supported by strong collateral ligaments. In other words, when we talk about collateral, they're on either side, outside or inside the joint holding them together. So the humeral ulnar joint, which is this one, and your interphalangeal joints. So your fingers can only flex and extend. Remember the famous Bugs Bunny exercise? Yeah, you got it. Do you remember it? On the Roadrunner? Don't you remember Bugs Bunny doing this? Right? Remember he did it with his ears too, right? I hated Bugs Bunny Roadrunner Hour. Thought it was ridiculous. Okay, so we can see here, hinge or ginglimus, just flexion extension. We can see it there in the elbow joint. A pivot joint is also known as a trochoid joint. We have rotation that occurs around a longitudinal axis. There it is. So these two vertebra are at the very top of your cervical spine. Okay, we have one that's a ring and one that has this little finger sticking up. Okay, and what happens is when we go no, this ring swings around that process, and that is a pivot joint or a trochoid joint at work. Yeah. Knee is a modified hinge joint because in flexion it can do a tiny bit of rotation. So you can see it spinning around here when we do no. So C1, which your head sits on, and then C2. So it spins around that process.
What is the name of this joint?
Don't worry about it. We'll get to it later. Okay? So it spins around in a longitudinal process. It is said to be pivot or trochoid. In other words, the process of one bone rotates in a ring or sleeve by another bone. So this is the atlanto-axial joint that we just saw between C1 and C2. And then we also, what is the proximal radial ulnar joint, that the proximal radius actually spins around in a sleeve, which allows for pronation and supination.
Is that here or here?
No, here. Yeah. Yep. You can see it there between C1 and C2. Is when we do no. The next type is called a condyloid joint, also known as an ellipsoid joint. This allows for flexion extension, ABA deduction, and circumduction. And yes, I do ask questions that way. Which of the following joints allows for whatever the question is? Okay? You have an oval concave surface that fits into an oval convex surface of the other bone. So, for example, the radial carpal joint between the distal radius and the carpal bones, the glenohumeral joint, and the metacarpal phalangeal joint. So you can see how you have an ellipsoid concavity that fits into an ellipsoid convexity. The next one is called a saddle joint, also known as the soleus joint. Soleus is Latin for saddle. It permits flexion extension, AB and AD duction, and circumduction. The opposing articular surfaces are shaped like a saddle that has both convex and concave surfaces. How many horsey people are here? Any horsey people here? Anybody into horses here? Yeah, Western or English? Yeah. So all you guys don't know this, but when I went to massage school to make money, I mucked stalls for like 2.5 years every morning with the men because it was an English barn. I hate horses. So picture a saddle and then turn the other one upside down so it fits on top. You get it? Either or, because it's you sit in the saddle, so you've got the saddle on the horse. Now, that picture taking another saddle and the way you'd have to turn it to fit it in so they'd fit together. So you would turn it upside down and twist it 1/4 turn, it would fit in, right? That's a saddle drain. So it's a saddle fitting on a saddle. Okay? So this is the first carpal metacarpal joint and the sternoclavicular joint. So it's this joint in the thumb. Yeah, it is, because it's you've got flexion, extension, abduction, adduction, and those two, it's biaxial because those two have to come work together to create circumduction.
Where is there circumduction in the saddle joint, like in your body?
Just the thumb right here.
But that's where's the saddle? Isn't that rotating down here?
Yes, that's it. That's the one there. It's a carpal metacarpal. Yep. Yeah, it's because your joint doesn't, something's wrong there. So you can see, does it make more sense? See the saddle with the saddle on top of it. Turned around, 1/4 turn and put on top. Right? The next one is, of course, your ball and socket, also known as a spheroid joint. It's the one that has all the movements. Flexion, extension, ABAD, internal, external rotations. Right? Has everything and does allow for circumduction because of those combination of movements. The spheroidal surface of one bone moves within the socket of another. They have the greatest range of motion. Of course, the glenohumeral joint is the shoulder, and the coxal joint is the hip. We can see them both there in the shoulder. And again, we've got ABAD, medial lateral rotation, and so forth. Okay? Ooh, awesome. Okay. So there endeth the joints. Now we have to move into muscles. This is exactly the way I'm going to teach you all the anatomy. I always teach you the bones first, then I teach you the joints, then I will teach you the muscles. So I'm addressing this information in exactly the same method. So muscles. Muscles are the organs, of course, of the muscle system. They account for just about half of your total body weight. They're basically muscle cells that are specialized to shorten. In other words, contraction is shortening of muscle cells. So muscle cells are an elongated cell, right? And when they contract, or when they're working, the two ends of the muscle cell come closer together, right? So that's exactly what contraction is shortening of muscle cells. Contraction can be defined as the conversion of chemical energy into mechanical energy, which results in movement. So we use chemicals that stimulate the architecture of a muscle cell, which results in movement. Now, whether that chemical is coming from the nervous system or whether that chemical is coming from within the muscle cell itself, we need chemicals to have physical actions to occur in the cell. There are three types of muscle in the human body. There is skeletal muscle, smooth muscle, and cardiac muscle. Okay? Now, skeletal muscle is where we're spending all our time in this course, right? There are muscle packages, or there's muscle cell packages that we call muscles. So when I say supraspinatus, infraspinatus, pectoralis minor, pectoralis major, multifidus, iliocostalis lumborum, and on and on and on and on and on, this is when we dissect the human body. We take these small packages out of that body. We look at where they attached, and we give them names. And that name can be how big it is, what shape it is, or where it is in the human body. But ultimately, every muscle you learn is basically a package of muscle cells.
Is there a rule for naming muscles like there is for organic chemistry?
When muscles were named, there was no refrigeration. Dull knives, and they, well, no, because you have to remember when dissection first started, science was very influenced by Greek and Roman classics, right? That's science was very driven by those things. So this is why we have some of the odd names we do. For example, I'm reading a book on the history of Rome right now, and starts out at 300 BCE and it's working its way up. But there's a bone, the roof of your mouth is called the Palatine bone. Yeah, it's based on a hill in Rome. So it's all based on classics. That's where a lot of these names come from. And names are changing, especially in diseases, because, again, arrogance, masculine arrogance back in the day would say, you know, I discover something and say, oh, that's Brian Dormer's palsy, because I wanted people to know, right? And so we're moving away from that sort of nomenclature and calling diseases as they are diseases rather than based upon the individual who discovered them or those sorts of things, right? They are the longest cells in the body are muscle cells, and they contain stripes within them, within their organization under the microscope. There's dark parts and light parts, and they're striated or striped. Although muscles can be activated by reflexes, they are considered to be voluntary. So when you decide to write the letter A on your piece of paper, you are voluntarily coordinating your muscles to create that letter A. So we can see here in the diagram, we have the striations here microscopically, but they do reflect out into the muscle mass itself. And if anybody here knows anybody or is into bodybuilding competitions, one of the big things they do is to dehydrate themselves to the point that the judges can see these striations. They're marked on it. Who's that? Anybody know? Ronnie Coleman. I'm pretty sure it is. In his early days, I believe it is. Not now, not with that big tummy. His hair's all the way down here. You sure that's not Ronnie? Doesn't matter. They're all stupid anyways, but do you know how unhealthy that is? Is it really? I thought it was Ronnie Coleman. You know what I don't like now are the new tummy ones? You know what that is? Roids. The tummy's roids.
That's roids too.
Yeah, that's roids too. Absolutely it is. Yes. In fact, I'll use the term I'm recording here, but there's a number of things that happen to the human body. This is such an inappropriate representation of what normal should be. It just drives me crazy. It's so silly. I don't see the potential for it. I don't understand what it's for. Yeah, that's right. That's right. What's it good for? I'm not sure. But it does help you with the striations. What's that? Hurt them? No, I don't believe so. Yeah, but don't forget, he's competing. You know what he looked like 6 months ago? They're still muscular as heck, but they're thick. They're big and fat. They almost look fat. They're so big, right? This is, they deliberately dehydrate themselves, and when these are done, they have to go on IV or they will die. There's virtually no water in that body. That skin is stuck to his muscles, and that's what they do. That's how they compete. Very unhealthy. We're not spending time in this class, but we will be in the next one. Is cardiac muscle. Cardiac muscle is only found in the heart. It is not voluntary. It works on its own. We're going to learn it actually creates its own pace. And although influenced by the nervous system, it can contract on its own, and we'll talk a whole lot about that. The other course, we can see it here. There are some configurations here in terms of working, how they work. The last one is smooth muscles. Again, we will not be discussing it in this class nor in AMP because you'll be doing the digestive system in your AMP 2 class next semester. So we find them in visceral organs, and their whole role is to move bodies like solid foods, liquids, and so forth. We do see some smooth muscle in vessels themselves, but the majority are we find in the gut. They are similar, but they're not striated, and they're not under voluntary control. They're completely controlled involuntarily by the parasympathetic, sympathetic nervous systems. Yes, it is. Yes. Contraction of smooth muscle is very low and sustained. So you know it as peristalsis, which is the sort of the coordinated effort that moves foodstuffs through the gut in a very coordinated manner. Okay. So what do? Obviously, they produce movement. So our ability to move around, run, jump, do all those sorts of things is completely the role of skeletal muscle tissue. Cardiac muscle, of course, is responsible for movement of blood, and smooth muscle is responsible for moving food materials as well as urine, and also in the reproductive tract for moving the ovum along, those sorts of things in its function. Maintaining posture and body position. You're not all aware right now, but all of your postural muscles are working right now. If you had a stroke and you lost the ability to control your postural muscles of your spine, none of you could sit in the chair. You would all slide off onto the floor. And you don't even realize that they're working at this point, actually holding you up in the chair. But this is why individuals who post-stroke in long-term care will have a seatbelt in the chair, because they have no core strength. They'll literally slide right out of the chair onto the floor. They're not able to hold themselves tightly. So right now, all of you guys are firing like crazy in terms of holding yourselves up. Right? What's that?
We're all working out right now.
We can say, in other words, that your muscles right now, and this is something to consider, is that what are we influenced by on this planet? Gravity. So we are all, again, designed to deal with gravity. I don't know if you guys have followed any of the space stuff, but when individuals go into space for long periods of time, it really does a number on their physiology. They actually, Chris Hadfield, do you know when he came back from space, he had osteoporosis really, really badly, right? Because our whole system is set up to be under the influence of gravity. So the way our muscles are set up and the work that they do is to do that. So, you know, our whole even standing where things are is to prevent us sort of from falling over. Stabilizing joints, I've already talked about that a lot. Remember, they have to cross the joint, and in doing so, they will help stabilize the joint in terms of it. So we can see here in the knee, for example. So this, again, just remember this for later. Someone's got a knee problem. You have a whole lot of muscles that you can work to strengthen and stabilize that knee. You have muscles in the posterior aspect of the knee that you can strengthen, at the lateral leg that you can strengthen, and the anterior and medial leg. You can strengthen all those muscles because all those muscles cross the knee joint, and in strengthening those muscles, you're going to stabilize the knee joint, especially post-injury. Generating heat, of course, muscle contraction, a byproduct of skeletal muscle contraction is heat, hence the reason why you shiver when you are cold. So as muscles contract, they generate heat as a byproduct. This does help maintain homeostatic parameters of core temperature. And because muscle mass accounts for about 40% of you, it has a large influence on the maintenance of core temperature. It does help protect some organs, and of course, smooth muscle, if we think about smooth muscle, it does help form valves and sphincters. So we can see here, for example, sartorius that's running down the front here from lateral to medial on the inside of the knee. Does follow a little bit of the femoral artery, so it was, you know, it's believed to be a little bit of a protector against the femoral artery. Not that it's a great one, but it's kind of there. Usually, each muscle is supplied by one nerve or more, an artery, and one or more veins. All of these enter or exit near the central part of the muscle, and once they penetrate through in the central part of the muscle, they branch extensively to go with every single fiber. Now, a muscle fiber, when we say muscle fiber, is a muscle cell, a microscopic muscle cell. So try to picture, if you can, how many muscle cells you would have in your biceps. Six. And every single one of those fibers needs to be innervated by a nerve. So one nerve enters into the muscle, and then it has to branch and touch every single fiber in your muscle. So it branches pretty extensively because it has to stimulate those if you're going to get a significant contraction. In skeletal muscle, each fiber is supplied by a nerve ending that controls its activity, and those nerve endings come from the spinal cord. via the spinal column or the spine. Skeletal muscle does have a rich blood supply, and there is extensive venous return as there's a lot of metabolic waste. So this is why, again, if you look at the individuals who work out extensively, especially with resistance training, they generally tend to have a pretty extensive venous system just under the skin, very, very large veins that branch extensively. And this is because the working out of muscles creates a lot of byproducts that need to be flushed out and dealt with. Yeah. No, but you have a greater possibility of affecting change because of all those branches. Yeah, but bruising is cardiovascular, not nervous.
Oh, not nerve damage.
Yeah. No. You can cause some bleeding, and you could do some nerve damage if you are not appropriate with pressure and you elongate that pressure for too long. But ultimately, because you have all these branches in the connective tissue, you will affect good change for it, because if you're going to influence one, the entire branches will affect. This is why you can work with a muscle and the whole muscle will be affected by the technique because of all the branches that work with it. But yeah, if I take a baseball bat to a muscle, can I do nerve damage to the muscle? Absolutely. Yeah. When we say that a muscle is supplied by a nerve, it is innervated by that nerve. So what do we mean when we say a muscle is innervated? Because we haven't gotten there yet, but every muscle that you have to learn with me is going to be where it attaches, what movements it does, and what nerve innervates it. Okay? So this is the discussion of the nerve supply to varying muscles. It's rare that there's variations in nerve supply. So when we do dissections and we follow nerves from the spinal column to muscles, it's pretty darn consistent with all human beings. Therefore, there must be some way for the message to go from the brain to the specified muscles to perform the job required. So again, some of you are writing and writing letters and so forth. That was trained in you many, many, many years ago in elementary school. So your brain is coordinating all the muscles it takes in your shoulder, your elbow, and your forearm to write that letter A or B or to do whatever you're doing. So we can see here then, and this is not to get complicated, you're going to do this in neuroanatomy, but you have what's called a motor nerve cell, an upper motor neuron. So a decision is made to perform a task. Let's just say throw a baseball. Okay, all the actions that occur to throw a baseball. All that initiation occurs up here of all the movements that have to happen in order to throw said baseball or swing golf club or write something in a piece of paper or brush your teeth or comb your hair. There's all coordination. Some muscles have to be stimulated to work and other muscles actually have to be inhibited and stopped from working in order for you to perform the task. All of that is coordinated up here. Those messages then travel through parts of the brain and go all the way down the spinal cord until it gets to the level of the nerve that speaks to that muscle. Obviously, in the spinal cord, if I want to affect things down here, it will go all the way down the spinal cord to the lower parts of the spinal cord. If I want to affect things in the upper limb, of course, it's going to travel down the spinal cord to the upper parts of the spinal cord that go out to the arms and fingers. Everybody follow me so far? Okay. Then once it leaves the spinal cord, it goes all the way out to each of those fibers and stimulates them chemically to cause a contraction or inhibition, either to contract or not being able to contract. For example, got bicep, got tricep. In order for me to do this with my bicep, what has to happen to triceps? It has to relax. It has to be inhibited. Because what would happen if both of them contracted at the same time? I would get no movement. Right? If the extensor is contracting along with the flexor, my net movement is zero. So for me to be able to do this, the nervous system actually has to shut this down. And that's happening all the time in you, and you're not even aware of it. So the message is inhibiting triceps at the same time that it's stimulating biceps. All coming down from the brain through the spinal cord, out the spinal cord, into the peripheral nerves, all the way out to those muscles in all those branches. Nerves pass into sensory, into, which are sensory, and out of, which are motor, of the spinal column. And these are called spinal nerves, and there are 31 pair of spinal nerves in the spinal column. The nerves that innervate the muscle are called motor nerves because they affect movement, so therefore motor. Spinal nerves from C1 to C7 exit superior to their corresponding vertebra. C8 exits between C7 and T1, and after T1, spinal nerves from T1 to L5 exit inferior to their corresponding vertebra. To clarify, C stands for cervical spine, your neck, T stands for thoracic spine, your thorax, and L stands for lumbar spine down here in the lower part. So if we look here, we can see that you can see there's the spinal cord, and you can see where nerves exit and enter through the vertebra to either gain access to or leave the spinal cord. So we can see here the vertebra. So from C1 all the way down, the nerves are above the vertebra, corresponding vertebra, up to C8. And then at T1, all the nerves are below the corresponding vertebra all the way down. Okay? Where are we here? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So this would be C8, and this is the bone T1, and then T1, T2, so you can see it there. So C8 lies between 7 and 1, but there is no C8 bone.
What is C8 then? It's a nerve?
It's a nerve.
Oh, okay.
It's a nerve, yes. So the spinal nerves of the C spine innervate the arm, diaphragm, muscles of the neck, and extrinsic muscles of the back. The spinal nerves of the thoracic spine innervate such structures as pectoralis major, intercostal muscles, which are muscles that lie between the ribs, serratus anterior and posterior. The L-spine nerves innervate muscles of the abdominal wall, lower pelvic organs, muscles related to the hip joint and parts of the legs. You also have spinal nerves all the way down in the sacrum, the bony part of the lowest, and these innervate some pelvic muscles and muscles all the way down the lower leg, down below the knee into the foot. Okay? So, what does that all mean? When spinal nerves enter into or through the body, they're given specific names according to the regions they may pass through, their length or structures they're associated with or close to. So, for example, if we look at quadriceps, which is in the front of the thigh, if I was teaching them to you, I would say, quadriceps, find attachments, and I give you the attachments, then the actions, and I would say it's innervated by the femoral nerve, L2, L3, and L4. So what the hell does that mean? It means that the nerves that go to that muscle originated at the L2, 3, and 4 levels. So if we were to follow the nerves out from the spinal column, we would see that the nerves that exit L2, 3, and 4 head down to quadriceps. Okay. Now, you'll notice that a couple of numbers are bolded, yes? They're the major innervators. So that means the majority of nerve to innervate that muscle arose from L3 and L4. If I were to do damage to the nervous system here, I did damage to L2, for example, that means potentially that muscle that's innervated by 3 and 4 would remain relatively strong. Correct? Because the majority of innervation comes from L3, L4. Does everybody follow me? Everybody understand? Okay, so L3, L4. Now, if I did damage to L3 and L2 and L4 are intact, would I suspect some more weakening than normal? And if I did damage to L3 and L4, what could I expect? Very little, almost no strength, muscles barely functioning. Does everybody understand that? I'm not feeling it yet. Let's go back here. So you can see we had the brain we talked about, and the message initially comes from the brain as to how a muscle is going to contract.
So you don't even realize it. Everything you're doing right now is being coordinated by an upper motor neuron in your brain. So there's a section of your brain that is responsible for initiating motor control of everything that you're doing, whatever it may be. Any coordinated effort you could possibly imagine, pushing up your glasses, writing a letter, diaphragm contracting, right? Having a drink of water, typing on your keyboard, it makes no difference. That's all coordinated effort. None of that coordination can occur without the influence of the nervous system. So every muscle that's needed to perform that task is a message that comes down the spinal cord, out a nerve that leaves the spinal cord, and goes all the way down to the muscles that need to work to perform the task. Does everybody follow that? Okay. Yeah. Skeletal. Phrenic nerve. Actually, it's two innervations, spinal and cranial. Anyways, so you want to do something. You're not even aware of it, but it's being coordinated by the nervous system via the spinal cord, out the spine, out the nerves to stimulate the muscles. So when we say a muscle is, say, L2, L3, L4, we're saying that L2, L3, L4, those three branches all come down to and innervate or penetrate the muscle and send branches out to every fiber in the muscle. Okay, so it's not just one level. In this case, it's three levels of the spinal column that can do that. There are some muscles that only have one level. There's some muscles that have two, some have three, and a couple have four. It really depends. I don't want to get that complicated in it. I just want you to understand that when I say to you, you know, this muscle is innervated by the blah, blah, blah nerve, C3 to C5, you kind of have a sense of where it's coming from. I'm not trying to get deeply into neuro right now. I just want you to get a sense of when I say that to you, that you understand where that nerve has originated from. Do you understand that part? Yeah? Okay. Now, when we get out here, so when we're talking here, it's levels, but when a nerve gets out into the body, we start giving it funky names. Brachial, ulnar nerve, radial nerve, femoral nerve, doesn't matter, right? But they're still all originated at levels in the spinal column, okay? So, you can see here that we've got C5, 6, and 7. We can see how they all branch together and then go out and get to a muscle. We can see the same thing happening here. See the L1 nerve here. See how it all branches and connects down and it goes all the way here. As a general rule, an easy rule to remember, the farther down the spinal column you go, the farther down the body the nerve innervates. So when we get way down here in the sacrum, we're talking down here in the feet. As we work our way up the L-spine, we start dealing with muscles as we work our way up. So generally speaking, C-spine, upper arm, T-spine, thorax, L-spine, and a little bit of abs, L-spine, abdominal cavity, a little bit of the upper leg muscles, glutes, and then we get down into the sacrum. Now we're getting down into here. They're cranial nerves. So we call these spinal nerves because they originate from the spinal column. Above C, above the cervical spine, all the muscles here are facial expression, mastication, your ability to chew. Those nerves all originate in the cranium. So because they originate in the cranium, they are called cranial nerves, of which there are 12. Anytime you see a nerve with Roman numerals, and I realize now that nobody learns Roman numerals anymore. Does anybody even know what I mean by Roman numerals? Yeah, because I've had classes before that said, well, I've never seen that before. So anytime you see a Roman numeral with a nerve, that's telling you it originates from the cranium. It's a cranial nerve. Every other one with C3, C4, T1, T2, L3, L4, they've all originated from the spinal column. Yeah? Now, attachments, there's two types of way that a muscle attaches to bone. There's an indirect attachment and a direct attachment.
The indirect attachment, we have the connective tissue of the muscle that extends out from the muscle as a tendon to attach to the periosteum of the bone. So, you know, traditionally I could, I kind of draw like this. I'll do a bone here. And then I'll do a bone here. Okay. And then we'll say this indirect attachment, we have a muscle belly that's here, which has the muscle tissue in it. And then we have a tendinous attachment here and the tendinous attachment there. That is considered to be an indirect attachment. And of course, because this muscle crosses this joint, it's going to affect that joint. And remember that a muscle contraction is shortening. So because this muscle in this position, if it's going to contract and get shorter, what direction is this bone going to move? If this bone doesn't move, and this bone does, and this muscle shortens, what direction is it going to go? Right, it's going to go this way. Always remember that when a muscle contracts, its two attachments get closer together. Okay? And that will help you a lot when I'm giving you certain actions the muscle can do, and you'll go, it does? And have your partner kind of do the movement and check out those attachments and see how they get closer together, whatever that movement is. So it's always getting closer together. A direct attachment is that has the connective tissue epimysium of the muscle adhering to and fusing with the periosteum. So an example of that is here in the scapula. Okay, here we have supraspinatus attaches here and infraspinatus attaches here. The majority of that muscle belly fuses onto the bone here, infraspinatus. It's fused entirely on. So you don't have a little skinny tendon attaching one end and the other. You have a big, thick attachment here and then a skinny tendon that heads out from here. So this, because it's a big, huge surface area that attaches onto the bone, that is known as a direct attachment. Any questions? So you can see here you've got, you know, these attachments. You can see it kind of coming over the top, and you have this indirect attachment here just on the tip of the tendon. As I said, you get this broad attachment with direct. Muscles are attached to bone or other structures in at least two places in relationship to the joint that they're to affect. In most cases, one bone is said to be fixed, not moving. Fixed, not moving. And in the other part, the other bone is movable. The part of the muscle's tendon that is attached to the fixed bone was traditionally called the origin, and the part of the muscle's tendon that attaches to the movable bone is traditionally called the insertion. But there's a problem with that. In some cases, it flips. So, for example, psoas major, it's a hip flexor. When the lower part of the attachment is fixed, it does this. It pulls down. If I fix this part, it does this. So you get two actions. So if the legs are fixed, it causes flexion. And if the upper body is fixed, it also causes flexion, but of the leg rather than the spine. So because if in this tradition, if you say origin's fixed, insertion moves, you go, well, yeah, but the same muscle, two different movements. So origin insertion isn't used so much anymore. You're going to find a lot more of proximal distal or superior, inferior, and those sorts of things. And the books are all over the place with it. Okay? So I have a general rule. Understand there's always two attachments. Understand that it has to cross a joint in order to affect it. And understand that when there's contraction, the attachments get closer together. Whether it's this one that gets closer to that one, or this one that gets closer to that one, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference. In the limbs, the origin typically lies proximal to the insertion, and because of that, quite a few authors will use proximal and distal as attachments. But we must remember that although we might say an origin is fixed, in some situations, as I just showed you, the origin can move with the insertion fixed. And I will be interchanging the terms for attachments. But as I said, The chief thing to remember is that muscles have two attachments and affect change. So what happens is in the book, you won't see it too much this semester, but in Muscolino's book, he'll talk about primary action and reverse action. So the primary action is kind of, say it's a flexor, but its reverse action is the part that traditionally moves is fixed, and you get this opposite thing happening. So he uses the term reverse action. In dealing with the core muscles, which we're going to be dealing with, there's not too much of that. But when you're dealing with appendicular anatomy, there's a lot more of that. I won't be teaching you that. I'll be on holidays, but you'll see it a little bit more there. So we can see here we got lots of different attachments, right? We heard we got gastrocnemius here in the calf. Here we've got long head biceps in the forearm. And here we have a muscle between the manubrium, sternum, and the clavicle with the mastoid process of the head. And you can just see all the various attachments that we get there. And, of course, that's the part that we're going to be learning here most of this semester is these muscles, their attachments, and their actions. You can occasionally get what's called an aponeurosis. So rather than a tendon, you get a big flat sheet of tendinous material that can act as a very broad attachment site. So sometimes the tendon extends as a broad flat sheet. This is known as an aponeurosis, and this is the major one in the body. So all your back muscles that affect posture, many of them that we are taking this semester, they have a very common attachment here. This in the lower back, so here's your gluteal region, here's glute max, here's your lumbar spine, here's a bit of your thoracic spine, latissimus dorsi, and so forth. This is all fascial tissue. This is one massive attachment site for all the muscles in the back. And this is known as the thoracolumbar fascia. Don't worry, we're going to talk a whole lot more about it. But is it, in fact, actually an aponeurosis, a big, broad sheet of tendinous tissue? And many muscles share that. You can see it in a human being. If they stand with a shirt off, you can see this very large, flat area just above the gluteal region. That sort of represents the thoracolumbar fascia where all these muscles attach. A single muscle fiber is called a myofiber, which is a single muscle cell, and they're called fibers instead of cells because they look hair-like or thread-like when we look at them. Each fiber is basically an elongated cylinder which can extend the full length of a muscle. Think of how long your quadriceps are. Think of a single hair traveling down the entire length. They can be some of the largest cells in the human body. We can see them here. They're all broken down into all the way down into a myofibril. Ultimately, a muscle, whatever we call, long head biceps, supraspinatus, whatever, is a huge package of myofibrils or muscle cells. So a muscle, when we name it, is a package of muscle cells. I got lots to choose from for the quiz next week, don't I? Okay. So, we said they contract. We have to name the contractions as well. So what kind of contractions do we get from skeletal muscle? The first is called isotonic. Isotonic is what you think of when we think about a muscle contraction. So in other words, as tension increases, the muscle shortens. As tension increases, the muscle shortens. This is known as an isotonic contraction. There are two types of isotonic contraction. The first is called eccentric, which is negative work. How many of you guys in the gym do negative work? Right? So what are you doing in negative work? You're letting the muscle get longer while you're breaking it and resisting the lengthening, right? This is now known as eccentric muscle work, okay? This is negative work. Tension is produced as the muscle elongates. If we go back to bicep curls, so this is eccentric work. This, the muscle shortening, is concentric work, okay? So this is known as a concentric contraction, also positive work. The muscle tension is produced as the muscle shortens. So both of them together are called isotonic contractions. Resisted lengthening is eccentric. Resisted shortening is concentric. So we can see it here, right? Now, what happens when there's no movement but a contraction? That is known as an isometric contraction. You still have tension being produced in the muscle, but there is no net movement. Right? So, for example, in a deadlift, what's happening at your arms? Are they moving? No, they are isometrically holding the bar, right, in place while all the other muscles do the work. They're concentrically contracting, but the muscles of the arm, they're not moving, so they're isometrically holding the bar in place. Yeah, just doing that and not moving and that tightening of the muscle is isometric. Okay. Back in the 60s, there was this big movement to have that as a form of exercise. So they felt that, you know, instead of trying to get our moms and dads and grandparents in the gym and all that kind of stuff, they had these little booklets the government sent out, and it was all isometric work. So you would take your hands and push them together to build your pecs and all that kind of stuff. It actually is not a bad intro to strengthening if someone has been injured and they're very, very weak post-stroke or post-surgical. They're not a bad exercise to do, but they're obviously not going to build anything of any kind of strength. It was called 5BX and 10BX. It was all through the military, and they all got them. I'd love to find the booklets because they're probably collector's items when parents had them, but they all came out of the military, and they would have been mid to early 60s. And it was for adults to do these exercises. It included what we now call burpees and push-ups and that kind of stuff as well. We now know how beneficial all those are now in some instances. But, yeah, back then it was how they promoted fitness. Muscles almost always function in groups rather than singly. When a particular body movement is needed, groups of muscles are coordinated to the single function. This is good, but not so good. So without even thinking about it, you never singularly use a muscle to perform a task. Your body coordinates a number of muscles to perform the task altogether, right? Follow me? From a rehab perspective, if a patient's come to you with a problem and you need to strengthen, your challenge is to isolate and only have the target muscle do the work. This is what muscle testing is. Have you guys talked about muscle testing in lab yet? We're going to be talking about it next week. So I'm then able to take a patient has a pain, I through a body position particular movement, I can make one muscle work by itself, not a group of muscles. So remember that for next week. The prime mover of the action. So if we look at an action, the prime mover is the muscle which acts the most to initiate and maintain the movement desired. So I will teach you a muscle, and in brackets it'll have P. It means that that muscle primarily responsible for that movement. Does everybody understand that? Right? Do you see the P? The synergists are all the muscles that assist the prime mover at any given time. And this is where when I look in the gym and I see people working out, I can chuckle sometimes because they're using a lot of synergists to perform tasks rather than the muscle they're really trying to isolate in the first place. Hence the reason why getting people in their head, instead of taking that 45-pound dumbbell, which is using all kinds of other muscles to do the work, get it down to 20 pounds and just isolate that muscle that you're really trying to work. So we can see it here. You know, we've got three muscles here that are all responsible for flexion of the elbow. Biceps brachii, brachialis, and brachioradialis. Here's a little quiz. Which one of these is the most responsible for elbow flexion? Brachialis, good for you. Biceps brachii, prime mover is supination. Brachialis, prime mover is flexion. And brachioradialis is prime mover of reverse in pronated position or in neutral for flexion of the wrist. Okay. So in other words, then, for shoulder abduction, the other thing is we have the agonist here. It's deltoid. The synergists are pectoralis major, supraspinatus, and trapezius. Keep this slide in mind when we're learning muscles to understand that, yes, there is a prime mover, but many times there are other muscles that assist in the movement, okay? We can see them all here all working together in that singular movement. Now, an antagonist is the opposite of the prime mover. So if this particular muscle we're isolating says it's an elbow flexor, the antagonist resists that movement. So if biceps is an elbow flexor, what would resist that movement? Or extension, right? So if the prime mover is a flexor of the elbow, there is a muscle that is opposite to that in the case of triceps, which is elbow extension. So therefore, in elbow flexion, the antagonist to elbow flexion, longhead biceps, is longhead triceps. So the muscles that resist the prime mover's actions and are responsible for movement in the opposite direction. Remember, in order for an agonist to perform its action, the nervous system has to inhibit the antagonist to relax and become flabby so that the prime mover can do what it's supposed to do. It is the other way around.
Yeah.
You are correct. But again, your reference point is what is the action that you're after? Because if I want to extend, I have to inhibit the flexor. In other words, the agonist can be whatever the agonist is for the action, and its antagonist gets inhibited. Keep that in here because you're going to learn something called proprioceptive neuromuscular facilitation, which is a type of stretch in the second half of the course, and it plays with this. The last thing I want to say, I know it's a bit late. Within a muscle, we have fascicles that run parallel to each other. So these are how all those fibers line up in relationship to each other. In some muscles, they run parallel to the long axis. In others, they can form patterns that are oblique to the long axis. But ultimately, the fascicular arrangement, so how these fascicles are arranged, again, structure governs function. How fast it contracts, how much it contracts, and how strong it contracts is completely based on the fascicular patterning. So the first are called parallel. The fascicles run parallel to the long axis, and they have flat tendons, such as the one in your neck, sternocleidomastoid. So you can see you have all these parallel fibers. They're all running parallel to each other, and you can see them all lying here. The next is called fusiform, and that's kind of what this guy is. You've got a wider in the middle, and it tapers out at both ends, okay? So the fascicles are nearly parallel, terminate in flat tendons, and the muscle tapers towards the tendons, and this represents biceps brachii in the forearm. You can see narrow at the ends and a bit thicker in the middle. That is known as fusiform. Circular, we get circular patterns. These are known as sphincters. And you have many of them in your body, not just the one you're all thinking of right now. Your muscles in your eye that open and close your eye is a sphincter. There's muscles around your mouth that open and close your mouth. That is a sphincter as well, and in many others. So when we see these are known as circular muscles because they are in a circular pattern. The other is triangular. So we have fascicles. They're spread out over a large area at one point and all narrow in a triangular pattern to a single central tendon, such as pectoralis major. So here we have the circular muscle here. This is opicularis oculi here around the eye. And we can see pectoralis major here, very broad and large, proximally at the chest wall, very narrow as it heads up to the humerus in this triangular shape. As well, we have infraspinatus here, which does the same thing. Now, pinnate are kind of cool. Pinnate is Latin for feathers. So the patterns of the fascicles in these muscles almost looks like a shuttlecock. So you see this sort of shuttlecock configuration. Fascicles, they run oblique to the long axis and they resemble feathers. So you can see if the fascicles are only on one side, they're called unipennate. If they're on both sides, they're called bipennate. And if they're on many sides, it looks just like a shuttlecock, doesn't it? Right, that's deltoids, that's multipennate. So these small muscles in your hand, lumbricals, are unipennate. The quadriceps here, rectus femoris in particular, is bipennate. And then your deltoid muscle has all this kind of configuration of fascicles here, is multipennate. Unipennate are on one side, as I said, right? We can see here. Bipennate, the fascicles are on both sides of the tendon. And of course, such as rectus femoris. And multipennate, the fascicles are attached from many directions to several tendons. So we can see deltoid here in the shoulder. The longer and more nearly parallel to the long axis, the more the muscle can shorten. They're not usually the more powerful muscles. The greater number of fascicles, the greater the power. Bipennate and multipennate, They shorten very little, but they're extremely powerful. So your deltoids are an extremely powerful muscle as a group, but their range of motion is very small compared to SCM, which is a very large range of motion. Okay, see ya. Guess we'll leave it at that. How many left? Is there only one or two slides left? Oh, let's finish this then. The last thing is naming of muscles. Come on, you guys should be excited to see all this stuff. So when we name a muscle, this is kind of really important. It's like ligaments. Ligaments will always tell you where they are in their name. The same with muscles will help you a lot, the way we name muscles. So adductor magnus, what would that tell you? It adducts and it's huge, right? Same tells you that. Quadratus lumborum. Four sides in the lumbar area. Biceps brachii. Two heads, and where's the brachii? Arm. Rotatories. Rotates. So always keep that in mind when you're learning the muscles. More often than not, the name basically will help tell you where it is, how big it is, or what it does. See ya. We almost got caught up. So next week, we just have one set of slides in regards to muscle testing and so forth. Please bring your skulls next week. Okay? Just the skull. Just need the skull. What's that?
Do we all need a skull?
Yes. Because you can draw on it, write on it, paint on it. Yeah, we're going to do the skull next week. No, get your own skull. You've got to take it home.